You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiation Science and the Development of the Human Mind. Collected Works, Volume 228. This is Lecture 2, given in Dornach on the 28th of July, 1923. Yesterday I spoke of the starry heavens closest to us. Thinking back on this, you will above all have to say, when such a characterization of the starry heavens is gained through spiritual insight, it is very different from anything that is generally said on the subject today. To make this clear, I spoke in a particular way about it yesterday. I had to speak about it in a way which must seem absurd, even ridiculous, to anyone who learns about the subject in contemporary education today. Yet the situation is that our sick life in mind and spirit can only find a kind of healing if there can be this complete change in the way we look at things, especially those we were considering yesterday. It seems fair to say that where thinking is done today, but in such a way that the thinking runs on the old, generally accepted rails, we see, on the one hand, that the thinking does everywhere point to this new form of spiritual insight. On the other hand, we also see that people are not in a position to go along the route that leads to that kind of spiritual view. So they are really at a loss everywhere. And, which is perhaps the worst part of it, at the present point in time, are not aware of their helplessness, and indeed do not want to be aware of it. Let us consider how the things I spoke of yesterday, from a completely different point of view, are described today. I spoke of Moon, Saturn, Jupiter, and so on, and of the individual spirits which we may connect with those terms. In a way, I presented our planetary system as a gathering of spirits which act on different impulses, but in such a way that these impulses also have something to do with the things that happen on Earth. We saw living entities with distinct character appear in the universe. We were able to speak of spirits alive in Saturn, the Moon, and so on. But the whole way in which one speaks is different from what is generally said about such things today. People assume, let me repeat this once more, that there was once a nebula and it was rotating. The individual planets, today regarded in complete indifference, more or less seen as luminous physical bodies rushing along in cosmic space, are said to have split off from the nebula. This view, that the heavenly bodies are such unimportant bodies, where all one can do is to use physics, and particularly mathematics, to calculate their orbits, and possibly investigate if the forms of matter found on Earth may also be found there, this indifferent way of looking at the heavenly bodies is something which has really only become customary in the last 300 or 400 years. It has become customary in a particular way. It is simply that people do not realize this today. Since we have lost the possibility of seeing into the spiritual, or as was the only remaining possibility in medieval times, at least of having an inkling of it, it has become possible for us to lose the spiritual altogether. People then came to see the physical concepts which they had on Earth, mathematical concepts, calculations, as something certain, and therefore also calculated the things that show themselves in the heavens. A particular precondition was established. I have to go a bit into these theoretical aspects today. That once people had learned how to calculate something on Earth, developing the science of physics, they would apply that science also to the whole of the heavens, thinking that the results of calculations made on earth also applied in celestial space. On earth we speak of time, of matter, of motion, and if we are physicists we might also refer to mass, velocity, and so on. All these are concepts gained on earth. Since Newton's day, this has been extended to cover celestial space. And the whole way in which people see what goes on in the cosmos is nothing but the result of calculations gained on earth and then flung out into the heavens. The whole of Kant-Laplace's nebular hypothesis becomes an absurdity the moment we realize that it applies only on the assumption that the same laws of arithmetic apply out there in cosmic spaces as on the earth, that the concepts of space, time, and so on apply out there just as much as on earth. Now there is, however, a strange fact, a fact that makes people rack their brains. We are living in strange times, as evident in many symptoms. At all the popular meetings held by monists and other leagues, it is said to be a certainty that the stars are shining out there because of the well-known processes. A gullible public is presented by popular speakers and writers with the beautiful theory of spiral nebulas and so on, which are apparent to the physical eye. And people get their education today from those popular speakers and writers. Essentially, however, this education is merely the result of things which physicists and other, in quotes, learned people thought up decades ago. Things are rehashed at those popular gatherings, which the experts considered to be true decades ago. Today, something quite different is exciting the experts. Today, it is the theory of relativity, for instance, which excites them. This theory of relativity, Einstein's theory of relativity, occupies the minds of the thinkers among physicists today. It is, of course, possible to speak about details of this theory the way I have been doing here and there, but today we will not consider its inner validity, but the fact that it exists and that physicists talk about it. There are also physicists who oppose it. But very many physicists simply are speaking of the theory of relativity. Now, what does this signify? It signifies that this theory of relativity is destroying all the concepts that are behind the view of the movements and nature of the heavenly bodies in cosmic space. The things still told to lay people today in popular talks and books and written in works on astronomy were accepted as the truth for decades. But the physicists are busy in breaking down, destroying the most popular concepts, time, movement, space, and say that none of it truly is the way people thought it was. You see, for physicists at least, it is now something like a matter of conscience to say, for instance, quote, "I direct my telescope toward a distant star, but I have worked out that so and so much time passes before the light from that star gets down to Earth. When I look through my telescope, therefore, the light I see has needed so and so many light years to reach it. The light in my telescope was therefore emitted so and so many light years ago. The star is no longer in the place where I see it. The ray of light reaches my telescope, but the star is no longer in the place to which the telescope extends. When I look at a neighboring star, the light of which needs far fewer light years, this light nevertheless gets here at the same time. I move the telescope. The star appears in a point of light, which perhaps was there so and so many years ago. Now I move it again. A star appears in the telescope which actually is not there, but has been there a completely different number of years ago. And that is how I form ideas about my starry heavens. All of it has been there since it came to be there, but in reality it is not there at all. In reality, there is nothing there. Everything has gone higgledy-piggledy. It is exactly the same with space. We hear a distant sound. The pitch changes as we come closer to it, different from when we move away from it. Space determines the nature of what we perceive. And that is, of course, a puzzle to people. Time, which enters into all our calculations, has suddenly become something quite uncertain, something which is merely relative. A modern physicist who would, of course, be fully aware of this can only say about everything which is pictured out in cosmic space in such a popular way, quote, something has been there once, is still there, will be there one day, yes, well, there is something there, and whatever is there is responsible for the fact that at a certain point in time, the light it emits coincides with the crosswires in my telescope. Close quote. The only wisdom which still remains for us concerns the coincidences of two events. Something which has happened somewhere at some time coincides with what happens in the crosswires of my telescope today. Quote, all we can speak of are such coincidences, says the modern physicist. All of it is relative. The concepts that make up the theory of the world edifice are indeed only relative and have no absolute validity. Close quote. And if you were to leave a gathering of lay people today and go immediately to a lecture given by a relativity theoretician, you would find that the popularizing speaker was handing something down to people based on ideas of which the experts would say, quote, all that has melted away like snow in the sun. Close quote. You see, it is not only that we can say that a physical view of the world has evolved from certain concepts in the last 300 or 400 years, we also have to say that there are enough people today who, in working with these concepts, have reduced them to nothing, destroyed them. That view of the world, which people think is so certain, no longer exists for a great many thinkers today. So it is, after all, not really permissible to say that something said from a completely new point of view may be ridiculed. For the things said from that other point of view are presently melting away like the snow in the sun. For those who know about these things, or at least want to know something about them, they are actually no longer there. The fact is, therefore, that people say, quote, the things described here from the spiritual scientific point of view are absurd, for they do not agree with the things we consider to be correct. Close quote. But, speaking from the point of view of relativity, these people then have to say, quote, the things we thought were correct are absurd. Close quote. That is how things are today. The majority of people are really asleep, and sleep as they watch these things taking their course. They let them happen. But it is important to know that the view of the world, which as such has been so triumphant, really lies all in ruins today. The true situation in the spiritual world will really only be clearly understood more widely when people raise the nightcap they are wearing at least a little bit. So it is certainly possible to think that something which speaks in the kind of tenor in which I spoke yesterday is absurd in the face of modern science. For in its theory of relativity, for instance, this science is wholly negative. It is really always telling us what is not, and humanity will need to steer toward insight into what is. These things have to be done with the kind of presentation I tried to make yesterday, speaking of individual stars in our planetary system. But what do we see there? We see that, in a sense, people follow the course of world evolution with great accuracy. What would an old-fashioned physicist, not a new-fashioned one, for they are mostly relativity theoreticians, say if he were to hear one say something as outrageous as I did yesterday? if he did not immediately say that all of it is rubbish and quite wrong, and that might well be what he'd say at first, he would certainly insist that it goes against the solid foundations of science. Yet what are the solid foundations of science? They are the concepts of space, time, and so on, which people have gained on Earth. Now, the relativity theoreticians destroy these concepts where the universe is concerned and declare them to have no validity. In anthroposophy, on the other hand, the approach is practical. The earthly concepts are left aside when speaking of Moon, Saturn, Jupiter, and so on. There we do no longer speak of the earthly sphere, but try, though it is not an easy thing to do, to characterize Venus and Mars in a way that cannot be done with earthly concepts. We have to agree to let go of the earthly concepts if we want to penetrate up into the universe. I wanted to show you how the cosmos has its position in present-day cultural life, and how things actually are in the life of modern culture. Only one relationship with the earthly concepts remains when we go out into the cosmos. Just consider, if we go only as far as the moon, as I characterized it yesterday, to the spirits which are anchored in the moon as in a cosmic fastness, and actually live behind the outer surface of the moon, where, if I may put it like this, they pursue their cosmic business. When we come to these spirits, which we can only do if clairvoyance sharpens our sight, we do find that they do their business in seclusion. Nothing which is inside the moon goes out into the world, and everything which does come from the moon has been cast back from the world. The moon does not take in the sunlight, but reflects it. And it also reflects everything else that happens in the universe. Everything that happens in the universe is reflected by the moon as if in a mirror. The things that happen inside the moon remain hidden. I did, however, say to you that the spirits which are holed up in this moon fastness and in the universe and pursue their cosmic business in there, had once been on Earth, before the moon split off from the Earth. They had been the first great teachers of human souls on Earth. The great, most ancient wisdom of which people speak is essentially a legacy from these moon spirits, who today live hidden lives in the moon. They have withdrawn there. When one speaks about the universe in this way, moral concepts enter into the ideas one is developing. We ask ourselves, quote, why did these moon spirits withdraw? Why do they do their work in hiding? Close quote. Yes, when they were still on Earth, they did indeed suggest a tremendous wisdom to human beings. If they had stayed on Earth, they would have been suggesting this wisdom all the time. But people would never have been able to enter into the age of freedom. Those spirits had made the wonderful decision, as it were, to withdraw from the earth, withdraw to a closed space in the universe. There they would pursue their cosmic business far removed from humanity, so that human beings would not be influenced any further by them. So that human beings would be able to take in all the impulses of the universe and be free spirits. Those spirits chose a new dwelling place in the universe for themselves, so that freedom would gradually be possible for human beings. Yes, that is talking in a different way from the way in which physicists talk. Hearing that the moon had split off from the earth, a physicist would simply calculate the speed at which this happened, the energies involved, and all of this always only with earthly energies, earthly velocities in mind. When we speak of the moon the way I did yesterday, those factors are simply ignored. Yet, when we ignore the physical aspects, there remain those decisions, those great cosmic moral impulses. From going on about physics, which do apply to conditions on Earth, we come to speak about the universe in moral ideas. This is what happens, that one does not merely establish theories which people are meant to believe, but the fact that there is a moral world order. Over the last 3 or 4 centuries, the human soul has grown quite confused because people said that it is possible to know something about the earth and, according to what is known about the earth, calculate the universe and establish Kant-Laplace's nebular hypothesis and similar theories. But when it comes to the divine moral world order, you have to believe. This has confused people enormously, because all realization has been lost that we must speak in earthly terms about the earth, but the moment we ascend to the universe, we must begin to speak in cosmic terms. There, physical talk gradually becomes moral talk. There, something is practiced which otherwise is at best only invented fantasy. When you see the way a physicist describes the sun today, you find it is some kind of gas sphere, steaming out there, and its eruptions are described as if they were eruptions on Earth. Everything is projected out onto this cosmic body the way things happen on Earth. And we then use the calculations we have learned to do here to calculate how a light ray passes the sun or the like. But the calculations, which apply here for earthly things, cease to be valid when we get out there. Just as the intensity of light is inversely proportional to the square of the distance from the source, so do the laws cease to be valid out there in the universe. And we are only related to the universe in our moral nature. Rising above the physical to the moral as human beings, we do here on earth grow to be similar to the morality brought to realization out there in cosmic space. We therefore have to say that anthroposophy is science to the utmost degree. Here demands are actually met. One is no longer speaking in earthly ideas, except for the moral ideas, and these are super-earthly even on earth. In anthroposophy, one refers to such moral ideas when one rises up to the universe. This must be thoroughly taken into account. And it is from this point of view that we must find the concepts which we need to understand what cannot yet be understood here on earth. You see, the spirits which are anchored in the moon only act, as I said, as if in a fastness. There they pursue their cosmic business. For everything that the moon gives to the world, to the earth, is reflected, mirrored. This situation has, however, only come about in the course of evolution. It was different in the past. When those spirits were still on the earth, they acted on the soft, say slimy form that the earth itself and all creation on it once had. And in both human beings and animals, the development of the spinal column was connected with the actions of those spirits. The spinal column of human beings and animals is thus a legacy from very early times, when the moon spirits were still connected with earthly existence. It can no longer arise today. The spinal column is a legacy. It can no longer develop anew today. For four-footed animals, the spirits fixed the spine in such a way that it remains in the horizontal. For human beings, they made it to be such that it could come into the vertical. With the vertical spine, human beings could then grow free for the universe and its influences at the moment when the moon spirits withdrew into their moon fastness. And so, we will gradually come to explain the earthly from the standpoint of the universe, and altogether judge spiritual impulses in the right way, even in earthly existence. The situation is that things have come into human heads which have actually only come up in the last 3 or 4 centuries, all of them merely because of the view that only things learned from physical events and the physical things on earth can be used to explain the whole of the universe. The whole universe has been made into a physical image of the earth. Now, however, people have come to realize, quote, something is coinciding with my crosswires, but it was there in the past, close quote. But the whole thing simply is not valid like this. When things are taken into account with regard to stars that are far enough away, a modern physicist can certainly say, quote, the map that I am drawing is of something that does not exist. I draw 2 stars side by side, one of them 1,000 years ago, let us say, the other 600 years ago. They have never existed side by side the way I see the light rays coincide in the crosswires. Close quote. So, it all melts away. It is not at all like that in reality. These concepts will not let us realize what is out there. You do calculation upon calculation. It is just like a spider spinning its web and then imagining that this web goes through the whole world. The reason is that the laws on which we base our calculations do not apply at all out there. At most, we can use the moral quality in us to gain concepts of what exists out there. Out there in the starry heavens, things go morally, sometimes also immorally, aramonically, luciferically, and so on. But if I take moral as a generic term, it is moral out there and not physical. This is something people will have to come to realize again. For over the last 2 or 3 centuries, the other view has fixed itself so firmly in human heads that even the doubts that come to the minds of relativity theoreticians, there's a great deal to be said for their negations, cannot drive it out of their heads. And we can understand this, for when even this last phantom, the time and space calculation they do, when this also vanishes from people's heads, when it comes to the starry heavens, nothing will be left in those heads, and people do like to have something in their heads. Something else can only be in there when people rise to the possibility of looking at the starry heavens in the way in which we did yesterday. We have to realize that all this indicates how necessary it is for people today to gain clear ideas as to what really happened in the last 3 or 4 centuries, with the outcome so far the greatest of all wars ever known on earth, and the chaotic conditions which will grow more and more chaotic in the near future. The demand humanity must face is that they do really get a clear idea of these things. And in this respect, it is interesting to cast an eye on the earth and cultural development on earth today. In the civilization in which Westerners, including their American offshoot, live, people do simply consider that everything which has developed in the last 3 or 4 centuries, under the influence of a phenomenally magnificent technology and magnificent transport and communications, which is also breaking down today, is so firmly established that anyone who does not think so must, of course, be a fool. It is true that the old culture of the Orient has gone into decline, but one must also say that the things which have to be said today, arising from the source springs of our own anthroposophical investigations, the way I said them yesterday, have in a far distant past been Oriental wisdom, though of a very different kind. As I have said on many occasions, we cannot escape this Oriental wisdom in the old form today. We have to regain it from within Western hearts and minds, from the Western soul. but I would like to say that there was a time when it was the custom to speak about the stars in the way in which I started to speak of them again yesterday, but out of the ancient clairvoyance, that dreamlike ancient clairvoyance. This is something humanity has lost altogether. And modern Europeans consider everything that once was seen as the most sublime human wisdom to be absurd. Well, as I said, it may once have been a magnificent original wisdom yonder in the Orient, but today the ancient culture of those people has gone into decline. Yet in a sense something still survives, at least superficially, as tradition in the Orient, a way of looking at the universe that has soul, I'd say. And the Orientals are not very impressed by Europe's technological culture. The very souls which today give loving consideration to the original wisdom in the Orient are essentially despising the mechanical culture and civilization which has evolved in Europe. They study the ancient writings to consider the human soul. This gives some of them an inner enlightenment, though subject to decline, so that something still survives in the Orient of seeing the world with the eyes of the soul. And it is not in vain, also, to consider the way in which these people, who have at least still some echo of an ancient culture, consider the cultural life in Europe and America. It may just be for comparison, but is interesting nevertheless. A strange book has appeared by a gentleman called Ramanathan, an Indian from Ceylon, titled The Culture of the Soul Among Western Nationals. He puts things in a strange way. He evidently is someone in the Orient, in Indian civilization, who has said to himself, quote, "These Europeans do also have very strange writings, such as the New Testament," close quote. Ramanathan and others have studied the New Testament, but this was of course done in the way in which their souls enabled them to study it. They took in the New Testament, the things done by Christ Jesus, according to their state of soul. And one can see from Ramanathan's book that there are people in the Orient who speak of Christ Jesus and the New Testament out of what remains of their most ancient culture. They have developed their own quite definite ideas of Christ Jesus. Ramanathan has written a great deal about those ideas, which he has of Christ Jesus, and he wrote the book in English for European readers. The book, written in the Indian spirit about Jesus in the Gospels, is therefore addressed to the Europeans, and is telling them something very strange. He writes that it was really quite peculiar that they did not know anything at all about Christ Jesus. Magnificent things were written about Christ Jesus in the Gospels, he says, but the Europeans and Americans have no idea, truly no idea at all. He gives a peculiar piece of advice to the Europeans and Americans, asking them to accept teachers of the New Testament from India. They would be able to tell them the true situation concerning Christ Jesus. The people over yonder in Asia, who are today concerning themselves with progress in Europe, and then read the New Testament, are therefore telling Europeans, quote, "If you want to learn something about Christ Jesus, you have to accept teachers from India, for none of the teachers who are talking to you now have any idea at all. Everything they say comes from failure to understand," close quote. Ramanathan goes into detail about this. He says that at a particular time in Europe, a way of understanding everything in words took the place of grasping the spiritual essence. Europeans depend on the understanding of words, in a way. They have no spiritual insight in their heads, but the words which they learn in their individual nations rise like vapor up into their heads, and they then think in words. It is strange how the Indians gained this insight, in spite of the decline in their ancient culture, for what they say is strikingly true up to this point. People think in words and not objects or situations today. People are really rather odd in this respect. Someone who wants to be taken to be really clever will quickly quote, quote, "For when concepts are lacking, a word will soon come up," close quote. Today this happens mostly when the person concerned has no concepts at all. Then Goethe's words will soon come to mind. But the person does not realize this. He does not know that he himself is desperately caught up in the self-same failing, even as he criticizes it. So this Indian is saying to the Europeans, quote, "You only understand things in words, and you have applied this understanding in words to the New Testament, and therefore made the Christ dead for 400 years. He is no longer living among you. He's been dead for 4 centuries. Find teachers from India for yourselves, so that he may be brought to life again." Close quote. This is what this Indian is telling the Europeans. He is saying that for 3 or 4 centuries the Europeans have simply known nothing at all about the Christ. They cannot know anything, because they do not have the concepts and ideas which make it possible to know anything about the Christ. The Indian is telling the Europeans, quote, "You need a renaissance of Christ Jesus. You have to rediscover the Christ, or someone else has to discover him for you so that you will have him again." Close quote. This is what the Indian is saying, since he has read the Gospels himself. He realizes, therefore, that strange things have been going on in Europe for the last 3 or 4 centuries. And he then says that if the Europeans wanted to realize for themselves again the Christ who lives in the New Testament, they would have to go a long way back. For this failure to understand the Christ has evolved slowly. And if the Europeans wanted to learn to understand anything about the Christ from their own documents, they would need to go all the way back to Gnosis. A strange phenomenon. There you have an Indian, merely representative of many, who reads the New Testament and tells Europeans, quote, "There is absolutely no help for you unless you go back to the Gnostics," close quote. But the Europeans really only have the Gnostics in the writings of their opponents. They do not know anything about the Gnostics. It is a strange fact that the writings of the Gnostics have all been eradicated. And all we have are the polemics of the Church Fathers against the Gnostics, the exception being the title Pistis Sophia, and a few other documents. The way these are, however, they can be as little understood as the Gospels can be. Now, if one is not a Gnostic, but finds the Christ again, thanks to modern spiritual science, the theologians come and say, quote, "This is a rehash of Gnosis," close quote, though they do not really know Gnosis, being quite unable to know it on the basis of some external things or others. But they say, quote, "It is not permissible to rehash Gnosis, for Christianity is falsified in Gnosis," close quote. Here we have a divergence between East and West. Someone studying the New Testament in the East finds that one needs to go back to the early centuries. When theologians of today think that the view taken of the Christ in present-day anthroposophy looks as if it is reminiscent of the Gnosis, which they do not know, they will say, quote, "He wants to rehash Gnosis, and that must not be, for it falsifies Christianity," close quote. The Indian's view does indeed sound strange. Ramanathan is really saying that Christianity as Europeans see it today has been falsified. The Europeans say that Ramanathan is falsifying our Christianity. It is, however, Ramanathan who comes fairly close to the right view, though his way of looking at it comes from a culture in decline. Something which is right is always a falsification of what is false. We just have to call a spade a spade. The true is always a falsification of the false. For one would not arrive at the true if one did not falsify the false. So that is how things are today. Just consider the abyss which opens up before us when we take this example of Ramanathan. Someone might, for instance, say, quote, "Read the Gospels without bias," close quote. It is difficult for Europeans to read them without bias today. On the one hand, they had to depend on the maltreated translations for centuries, and they have been brought up to have certain ideas. It is difficult to read them without bias. Yet when someone reads them without bias, even if from his particular point of view, he will find a spiritual Christ in the Gospels. Ramanathan discovered that spiritual Christ in the Gospels, though he is not yet able to see him in the anthroposophical sense. But the Europeans should at least take note that this Indian from Ceylon is advising them to have preachers about the Christ come from India, seeing that they do not have any. With things like these, we must have the courage today to look into developments over the last 3 or 4 centuries. It needs this courage to get out of the tremendous chaos into which humanity has been gradually getting itself. This tendency to be unclear clouds all concepts and ultimately also brings social chaos. For the things that go on between people do, after all, come from their souls. And there certainly is a connection between the most sublime truths and the destruction of external economic conditions. We must accept that we have to let go of earthly concepts if we want to rise to the universe. In yesterday's lecture, I sought to give you an example of how the cosmos relates to life in the spirit today, and how things are in that life in the spirit. A kinship with earthly concepts exists only when we get out into the cosmos. The end of Lecture 2. And I forgot to mention, these lectures are translated by Anna Moyse.